President Obama's announcement to end the war in Iraq at the end of the year was seen as the right move by a majority of Americans, 71% to be exact, as per a November 2011 Wall Street Journal poll. That war, fought for nearly 9 years, was initially popular with the public, but quickly became the hallmark of George W. Bush's failed foreign policy. Meanwhile, the longest war the U.S. has ever waged rages on in Afghanistan, where attempts to broker peace between Afghanistan and the Pakistan-sponsored Taliban recently failed. The U.S.'s practice of nighttime raids in Afghanistan have come under scrutiny once more, with the death this last Saturday of a pregnant woman in Gardez. The woman, who was 8 months pregnant, was killed when her house was surrounded by U.S. troops and her husband and son arrested. And in Libya, where U.S. forces joined NATO in a short war to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi's regime this year, chaos still reigns. Despite the end of the dictatorial government, there are far too many reports of atrocities being committed against Gaddafi loyalists. In a new book commenting on the state and impending decline of the American empire, Nation Institute fellow Tom Engelhart lays out his analysis of how the U.S. is going down the same path that the Soviet Union went down. Namely, we're pouring so much of our national wealth into the military-industrial complex, fanning the flames of public fear to justify the expenditures, that it's only a matter of time before the world's sole superpower faces the same fate as its Cold War rival. The book is called The United States of Fear, and it's written by my guest Tom Engelhart, the creator and director of TomDispatch.com and a fellow of the Nation Institute. His earlier books include The American War of War, The End of Victory Culture, and a novel called The Last Days of Publishing. Welcome to Uprising, Tom.
Good to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, it's interesting to see just the two main wars that the U.S. has been waging for about the past decade change, or, you know, to compare them with each other. We have the Iraq War, which was the war that Bush really wanted to fight and made lots of excuses to go into, ending, and the war that Bush seemed to not care about as much, being taken up by Obama and continue on even after it's earned the distinction now of being the longest war the U.S. has ever waged. How do you analyze where Obama is on these two wars?
Well, I would use one word, and it would be debacle. It's a word that isn't much used. I mean, I've been struck by the Iraq coverage, which has been kind of a stalemate. We made gains after the initial disaster. You know, we're getting out. It's kind of, if it's not a success, we should still be proud of it. You know, but I thought the most striking account, I mean, the thing that the account I saw that told me most about the nature of where the Iraq war went was an account in the New York Times of the last unit leaving Iraq, the last American unit. And before they left at 2:30 in the morning, that is in the dead of night. And before they left, they sent their interpreters out to the military people, I assume, that they had been working closely with, and made appointments for the next day, when they were, of course, going to be gone. And this tells you something very simple. The last American troops left Iraq in the dark, and even the Iraqis they were closest to, they didn't trust to tell that they were going. They didn't even say goodbye to, because, you know, I mean, this was, I mean, functionally, this is the definition of defeat and debacle. When you have a superpower that leaves a war this way, you know you've lost. It's just basically people don't say it here. I mean, so that's Iraq. Afghanistan, I mean, Iraq is a kind of an ending debacle, but not quite ending, because, of course, we're leaving in Iraq this giant mission at what we call an embassy, but it's not. It's the last base in Iraq, really. We built, it turns out, we now know 505 bases in Iraq, small to giant. And this is the last one, the giant billion-dollar embassy in Baghdad that's going to have a quote, mission of 16,000, 17,000 people, including 5,000 armed mercenaries with a small air force of armed helicopters and so on and so forth. Just enough people to make sure that the trouble continues. I mean, what they're going to be able to do is minimal, but nonetheless, it's a sign of the urge not to leave. Let's say that in Afghanistan, you have an ongoing debacle, and the most striking part of which at the moment has to do with Pakistan, because it's the least, for a superpower, it's probably the least practical war to fight in the world. Forget any other factors, because the U.S. can only fight this war based on two other countries, Pakistan and Russia, because all our supplies, one way or another, come through those two countries. And, you know, all you have to do is think about that for a second. Right now, the Pakistanis have closed the border because of an incident in which a lot of the Americans killed a lot of Pakistani, 25 Pakistani troops. If that border stays closed, I don't think it will this time around, but if that border were to stay closed, we couldn't fight the war anymore. I mean, American generals are talking about staying beyond 2014, et cetera, et cetera. The same kind of talk that you heard about Iraq, but it is another devolving war.
Well, let me ask you this. Is the only difference between the Iraq war and the Afghanistan war in terms of why our troops are still there simply that the Iraq war was really unpopular during the Obama campaign for president, and so he pledged to end it, whereas the Afghanistan war was one that he could hold on to sort of keep his credentials as a tough war president? Is that the only difference, you think?
Well, it's certainly a major difference. I mean, because, you know, now let's remember, by the way, it's worth saying that the Obama administration actually didn't want to leave Iraq. So let's not just look at it as the Obama administration. It's very clear from the negotiations at the end that the U.S. wanted to keep maybe 10 to 20,000 troops instead of, you know, 100 military people in the embassy and maybe 600 or 700 trainers that may actually still be there, according to the Prime Minister al-Maliki. But they didn't actually, even though they said they were going to leave, they really wanted to maintain troops. In the end, for complicated reasons, the Iraqis wouldn't let them stay. But nonetheless, the answer is at least partially yes, because the Obama administration doubled down twice in 2009. On surging in Afghanistan. So it sent an enormous numbers of troops. And it committed itself through 2014, and that's just combat troops, and then for whatever beyond. So I think the answer is yes. I've always believed that it would have been painful, you know, but that the president could have actually... He actually had the capital when he came in to get us out of both wars, and he could actually have done it. I mean, there's a nasty sound machine in this country. We know it, a right-wing sound machine. It would have been ugly sounding, but I think it would have turned out to be a popular move. But the wisdom in Washington certainly was no Democrat can afford to get out of two wars at the same time. There's no historical evidence for this, but I think it was a deep-seated belief, and I think that's what they went with.
Well, Tom Engelhardt, in your book, The United States of Fear, in the chapter Entering the Soviet Era, you have a section called The Urge to Surge, and these military tactics in both wars that have involved surges of troops, what have they meant for you? How do you analyze them within the broad strokes of viewing American empire and its decline?
I think it was a kind of, I look at it as a kind of a drug experience, really. I mean, that's why I call it the urge to surge. It was like... I mean, you have to go back for this and say that you had a group of people who came to power in 2000. This was the Bush administration, and they were visionaries. They were geopolitical visionaries of a mad sort, a delusional sort, and they were deeply in love with the previous crew in the 90s. Had been kind of our economic jihadis, the neoliberals, and they had gone out to kind of flatten the global economy. But these people were romantics about the U.S. military. They believed that the U.S. military was so powerful it could do anything. And all they wanted to do was let it loose. I mean, it wasn't that they wanted to go into Iraq. They did. But Iraq, they just saw Iraq quite realistically in a certain sense as an initial step. The word they used for it was going to be a cakewalk, because they knew that Saddam Hussein's army was very weak. They thought they would hit Iraq, and then, of course, Syria would be caught in a pincers with Israel on the other side. It would have to bow down. The Iranians would be caught in a similar pincers between U.S. Afghanistan and U.S. Iraq, which was a country they were going to garrison for infinity, and that the Iraqis would love to have us you know, it would be like the South Korean situation. They'd be happy to have us. The Iranians would go down. And, if you know, there was a neocon quip of that period, which was, I think I can remember it pretty accurately, everybody wants to go to Baghdad, that is the Iraqi capital, but real men want to go to Tehran. And this is what they expected. They thought they were going to create a, they were going to establish a Pax Americana in the, what they called the arc of instability before they knew how unstable it could be, or the greater Middle East. And that urge to, the urge to surge started with that. It was the urge to surge beyond Afghanistan into Iraq. And then when things started to go wrong in Iraq, to surge in Iraq. Once you get it in your blood, it's like, even though you can kind of see potentially that it that it won't work, I think there's a kind of way in which they just couldn't stop. And of course, they basically took a modestly, a slowly declining great power, the only one on the planet at that moment, and kind of got behind the wheel and kind of headed the car towards the cliff. So they really shoved it along, and I think we can see the results right now.
I'm speaking with Tom Englehart. His latest book is called The United States of Fear. Well, let's discuss how the expenditure of so much of our national wealth into the military-industrial complex is playing into the decline of the American empire. 2011 was also the year where the use of unmanned drones became even more popular. There's even a caucus in Congress, the Drone Caucus, where there's, you know, lawmakers so excited about the use of this technology. I mean, I have to say it's akin to boys wanting to play video games. And you've written about the drones as well. How do you view the, or how do you compare what the United States is doing in its obsession with military hardware, comparing that to the Soviet Union?
Well, first, just to speak on the drones for a second. You know, since I think it's clear that we're not going to, there aren't going to be more Iraqs and Afghanistans, the U.S. is going to rely ever more on, I mean, what the U.S. I think is going to do is retreat to the sea, its naval power, and the air. And the one thing we know about air power, and it doesn't matter whether there are pilots in the plane or not, is air power is hopeless for political reasons. It's bound to be a disaster. I mean, the one striking example we have of it right now is that those drone attacks in Pakistan, which have killed a lot of people, and certainly a bunch of al-Qaeda and Taliban mid-level people and a couple of leaders and so on and so forth, that they have turned, helped to turn, like, I mean, when they do opinion polls on drone attacks in Pakistan, 97% of Pakistanis, a number you can't get on any poll, oppose them. You know, this is, they are going to prove startlingly ineffective. The answer on the Soviet Union is, the weird thing is in 1991, the Soviet Union disappeared. Washington was shocked. You know, they didn't expect it. It just basically evaporated. Why did it evaporate? It evaporated because it had rising deficits. It had an aging and desperately beyond fraying infrastructure. It had been for years pouring its money into the military, and it was stuck in, and it had been until that moment, almost that moment, stuck in a desperate, what its leader called the bleeding wound, a desperate quagmire in Afghanistan. Now, this should sound familiar to us, and the amazing thing was that the American leadership, after a pause, looking at this situation, made the decision functionally to follow what I call the Soviet path. They went in the same direction. You know, having looked at this and seen the Soviet Union imploding, they simply imagined themselves as the victors. They couldn't imagine that the far wealthier superpower, which was us, could also be heading very slowly and wreathed in self-congratulation for the exits. And so they began doing the same thing. They poured money into the military. I mean, we are now in a situation, very simple, where in the Soviet period, in the Cold War period, there was an actual enemy. I mean, So defined in Washington. It had a huge nuclear force. It had a huge military. It was real. Now we have an enemy that might be maybe a few thousand jihadis scattered around mostly the backlands of the planet, some wannabe al-Qaeda types, you know, again, a scattering of people, a couple of minority insurgencies that we nonetheless couldn't actually beat in these wars. And for this, we've, you know, staggeringly increased the Pentagon budget, enormously increased the intelligence bureaucracy in Washington. I mean, we've created a national security state that dwarfs the the Cold War period. I mean, this is like almost, this is where a lot of our wealth has gone. In a way, you could say that it's not that the U.S. hasn't had in bad times, it's not that it hasn't had a stimulus package, it's just had it in Kabul.
And yet this year saw an unprecedented rise in the number of popular uprisings all over the world, starting in Tunisia actually over a year ago in the end of 2010, Egypt and on, all the way to the United States. There's even reports of Occupy movements in China taking hold. How do you see this fitting into the decline of the world's sole superpower? Are we seeing the rise of a new superpower, meaning, namely, popular resistance and people's movements?
You know, it's funny. At the time of the it just sparks a thought in me. At the time of the failed attempt to stop the Iraq War, when millions of people went out into the streets all around the world, one New York Times reporter called that anti-war movement the other superpower.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the answer is, all we know at this point is that the one great superpower left on the planet is distinctly in decline, that another superpower, if you want to think of it that way, the Eurozone, is in real trouble, and within a couple of years we might end up with Eurozones, and that the third great economic power, China, you know, at this moment has a giant real estate bubble and may have its own set of problems. And that right now, you know, the other day, you say Chinese peasants, the other day 30,000 Chinese peasants were out blockading, occupying some road to stop, as a protest to stop a coal plant from coming into an area. I mean, this is like, some of this is startling. It's like the zeitgeist of the moment. It's happening all over the world. And I think it's a sign that we are quite literally, in terms of everything we were familiar with, on a destabilizing planet.
But at the same time, do you see this destabilization as necessary? Because if the American empire has been good only for the imperialists and bad for the rest of the world, we may have instability from the uprisings around the world. But is this a sort of necessary rite of passage to enter a multipolar world, a world that is more democratic, less unipolar, and where public opinion matters more and public action is taken more seriously?
Well, you know, I would answer this with great hesitation for this reason. You know, I should at this moment be flying around on a jetpack in an aspired city, because that's what I was promised as a kid. All I'm saying is, human predictions are we can't stop ourselves from predicting, but we are terrible at predicting the future, uniformly terrible. So the answer is, I don't know. All I can see is that something extraordinary is happening on this planet. I've called it the third occupation. The first was the jihadis, the economic jihadis, who went out to flatten the planet economically and helped to create that gap, the 1%, the 99%, in a major way globally. The second was our military jihadis, who drove a hole directly through the greater Middle East. That was the Bush era and beyond. And all of that created a moment, a totally unexpected moment. It makes sense when you look back at it, but nobody expected it, a moment that clearly isn't. It's not just the Arab Spring. It's not just Occupy Wall Street. It's clearly a global moment. I mean, there's no way of knowing where it will go. I mean, am I encouraged by it? Yes, I am. But I'd hesitate. I mean, I simply think 2012 is going to turn out to be a rather hot year.
I'm speaking with Tom Engelhardt. He is a fellow at the Nation Institute, and we're discussing his book, The United States of Fear, taking a look back at this year, 2011, the wars we have fought, the ones we are continuing to fight, the ones that are ending. And I didn't get to Libya. Tom Engelhardt, I'm wondering whether the war in Libya, which is, which can be seen in the same light as, for example, Clinton's adventure in Kosovo, these short wars for supposedly humanitarian reasons, these are favored by democratic presidents, or at least these are the kinds of wars that are often started under democratic presidents and usually don't last too long, even if they also leave chaos in their wake. Do you see Libya as the kind of war we may see more of in the future as the American empire desperately clings to, you know, justifying its existence along with NATO and Europe?
Yes, I think we're going to see. I mean, I think the kind of war we're going to see now is going to be much more. I mean, only the Libyan part of it is the drone part of it, the drone and plane part of it. That is war from the air. That will be combined, I think, globally with a kind of smaller scale war on the ground, which is, in the last years, one phenomenon that's been only. I mean, Tom Dispatch, my website, has been keeping track of this, but it hasn't been paid too much attention to. I mean, there's great fascination with the special forces, but what's striking about the special forces is that what had once been actually special forces, that is small elite units, has been built up into what's the equivalent of a secret army, a large secret army inside, or military inside our military, because each branch has them, so I can't just say army. And this secret military is, I think, going to be what's going to be used around the world along with the drones. You're going to get special operations forces backed by drones, and I think in the case of Libya, we don't know how Libya is going to turn out, but I think it clearly impressed the Obama administration and many other people in Washington as kind of the way to go. You know, no casualties as long as you're only thinking about Americans. Relatively cheap, successful. The only problem is that I suspect it won't turn out to be in success terms. Forgetting what literally happens to Libya, even in immediate success terms, I don't think it's going to turn out to be a very effective or practical way to go, really. I mean, I think you have a kind of a one-shot deal. I mean, Kosovo was similar, and that's just what I think. I think it's certainly an initial hint at the direction that the U.S. is going to go once it decides to really get its troops off the greater Middle Eastern mainland.
Well, Tom Engelhardt, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And TomDispatch.com is the best website to read your writings.
Yes, it is. That's where to go.
TomDispatch.com again, and you can check out Tom Engelhardt's book, The United States of Fear. It should be in bookstores, not just published by Haymarket Books. Mike Davis calls it a stunning polemic. Jeremy Scahill calls it a tour de force. I want to thank you so much, Tom, for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you a lot.
Thank you. Tom Engelhardt is the creator and director of TomDispatch.com and a fellow of the Nation Institute. His earlier books include The American Way of War, The End of Victory Culture, and a novel he wrote called The Last Days of Publishing. We've been taking a look at the wars of 2011 and what they mean for the long term of the U.S. empire.